Thank you for this first day of practice, all of you. It's a, I believe it's a wonderful thing to engage in this practice we do, in retreat practice. I'm sure some of you had doubts about it today. The first day of retreats are often difficult. And if it's been difficult, I hope you take encouragement from the fact that you've now joined a group of people who down through the ages have done the very thing that you did and sat down and faced the fire and faced their demons, faced their challenges. And it's a kind of fire facing, demon facing, challenge facing, where what we're really facing is ourself, really meeting ourselves. And as we meet ourselves, we meet that part of ourselves that is not at peace. Somehow sitting here quietly, trying to be focused and attentive, be as fully present as we can, what we encounter is all the forces and momentum from a lifetime, perhaps, that doesn't allow us to do that, that has us mind wandering off, reacting, resisting, anger, resentments, desires, fantasies, all kinds of things that go on, churn away. And it's in Buddhism we say it's a noble endeavor and leads to a certain kind of nobility to face these things and see them to the other side and discover a nobility of spirit, nobility of heart, that is capable to be deeply at peace and compassionate in this world. There's the Zen master Dogen, lived in the 13th century. This poem is supposed to be the last poem he wrote. I don't know if it's a death poem or not, but I'm going to read a few lines from it and then save the last line for later. All my life, false and real, right and wrong, tangled. Playing with the moon, ridiculing the wind, listening to birds. Many years wasted, seeing the mountain covered with snow. He lived deep in the Japanese mountains. So all my life, false and real, right and wrong, tangled. So many of us get caught up in ideas of what's right and wrong. There are certainly things that are appropriate and not appropriate, or helpful and not helpful, but right and wrong, especially religious people and people involved in spirituality, sometimes have very rigid ideas of what's right and wrong and false and real. Many Buddhists get caught up in this idea of false and the real, and the idea that there's a false reality, a delusion or illusion, we live in an illusion. But there is something real, and we can just find what's real beyond the illusions that we live in. Playing with the moon, ridiculing the wind, listening to birds. Japanese poetry, whenever you see the word moon, you know we're talking about something symbolic. And the moon is a symbol for enlightenment, an enlightened mind. So playing with enlightenment, playing with this, you know. And then ridiculing the wind. I don't know what he means, but in Buddhism we have the eight winds. fame and ill repute, success and failure, pain and pleasure, success and failure. I forget all eight at the moment, but these common winds of society that we kind of get caught up in, that have people swirling around and chasing it and avoiding it and upset. And he's ridiculing all the chase for fame and money and success and status and many of the things that people, the winds of the world that people get swept up in. And listening to the birds. I'm not sure what the birds symbolize. Maybe it symbolizes nature. Somehow, the natural world, that's the place. Many years wasted seeing the mountain covered with snow. How could that be wasted? Some of us go up in the mountains in the wintertime and love seeing the mountain covered with snow. It's just a beautiful sight sometimes. So I'll get back to the poem at the end. So the theme for this retreat is the seven factors of awakening. And one of the ways of understanding these seven factors is that they represent the journey of practice. And we're on a journey together, moving through. Some of you know that Buddhism offers a path of practice, and many versions of what that path is. But a path is something external, something you walk on out there, something you do and you think. But the journey involves the person who walks the path. So, the path is there whether you walk it or not. The journey exists when you walk it, and it's more the subjective experience of the journey. And so I like to think of this as a journey, and the seven factors of awakening have to do with some of the different stages or steps along that journey of change and transformation that can happen. It can be seen in other ways. It doesn't have to be a progression, but that's one of the classic ways of understanding it. And this way we start with mindfulness as the foundation, the entryway to the journey. And the final step of the journey is equanimity. Because with equanimity is the door to a liberation or freedom. And I love this idea of the seven factors of awakening. We call them in English awakening. And the Buddha's awakening is kind of synonym with the Buddha's enlightenment. Because one of the things I like about it, say being awake, is I hope that all of you have had sometime in your life some experience of being conventionally clearly awake. Like you take a nice nap, everything's settled and fine. Maybe it's, you know, a day off from work, a day off from responsibilities. You can kind of unwind. You take a nap in the afternoon. You wake up and there's this beautiful light streaming through the window and things are peaceful and quiet. And you wake up and you feel really clear and really kind of rested and nice. And you kind of feel, and sometimes so poignant, these moments, that the idea of being awake, like, oh, I'm really awake, like feels to be awake, to be clear, to be alert, to be aware, stands out in highlight. It's like, yes, I'm here, it's peaceful, it's clear, it's settled, I'm relaxed. And boy, and I know that's the case. There's a kind of clarity to the knowing. Well, yes. And that awake moment of waking from a good, simple nap and being so clear has a number of qualities that maybe we wouldn't think about or look for if we didn't. But these seven factors of awakening are built into these qualities of this kind of awake mind, conventionally awake. There is a presence of mind where we know what's happening. We're present, we're registering, we're aware of what's happening. Part of the delight sometimes of that untroubled waking up from nap, when we're no longer concerned about our problems or issues or things in life, is we're just there in the room with the light streaming in. It's like, we're present, we're aware, we're registering the fact that the light is streaming through the window, the room is quiet, peaceful, there's, you know, the color of the walls, the texture of the curtains, and just like, just there. There's no effort to be mindful, but there's a mindfulness that registers what's there. And there is some investigation. Investigation and mindfulness are closely related, they overlap maybe. And sometimes, you know, in this clear state of being awake, you look at the ceiling, and the texture of the ceiling is interesting. You know, like, wow, I never looked at the texture before. Look at all that. And or there might be other things in the room that, you know, look at how this is. You know, and we kind of study it and take it in a deeper way. And that in this simple, relaxed, clear, wakeful mind, there is energy. It's alert. It's certainly not tired or groggy or sinking. It just kind of, there's energy. But you wouldn't call it energized, not like you're hyped up and engaged. It's just there's a kind of a energy which is kind of clear and simple and almost invisible, because it's not really doing anything, but it's there. And then there's a kind of simple joy or contentment, or it seems very satisfying. It's delightful. I've been sometimes in those kind of situations. Why do I want to leave? I don't want to go anywhere. You know, I have things to do maybe. And like, what, this is so nice. It's kind of some kind of joy or well-being. So I don't know if there's samadhi or concentration there in this kind of state, except that that sense of being very stable and settled and being really here, like laying on the bed, looking at the ceiling, not wanting to do anything else, just feels like you're rooted, you're there in a grounded, full way. This idea of being rooted and grounded, it's connected to samadhi, just being, I'm really here. And then there's equanimity. Perhaps some of the concerns of your life do kind of drift in. And as the concerns, normally you get react to them, get upset, or whatever. You kind of see these thoughts and concerns kind of drift through. It's like, oh yeah, well, later. But you know, there's the mind of that's equanimous is a mind that sees what's there very clearly, but doesn't get riled up by it, doesn't go for or against the experienced. Just drifts through and we let it be. We don't get involved. As we practice the path of Buddhism, these seven factors of awakening get stronger and stronger. And rather than being so strong that they become somehow, they stand out in highlight. And they become powers that support us and guide us through our lives. That the mindfulness becomes a power. And that it's not something you have to muster up. I've got to be mindful. I could, you know, my mother, you know, be mindful and okay, you know. And so then you kind of like start noting what's going on. And it's rather the mindfulness is just there, almost like automatic. It's a natural functioning of the mind that has power or strength to it. And you know it's strong because you recognize it. You recognize its operation. Often when we are in our lives, we will often cut up with our concerns, and we're not aware of being aware of our concerns. We're not aware of what we're aware of. We're not aware of the awareness that's aware. Does it make sense? Okay, so what I mean is that I could be drinking my water here, and some conventional way, I know I'm drinking my water. That sounds silly, right? But the knowing of drinking the water can be so acute and so strong that the knowing itself is more acute and stands out more in highlight than actually drinking itself. But often we're so involved with what we're doing that the awareness that knows is not recognized or appreciated for what it is. After all, awareness has no monetary value, right? You can't show it off to your friends. Look, it's, you know, because it's kind of invisible. But awareness stands out. Sometimes, I don't know if you have any of you have ever had a near accident. I hope it was a near accident. You know, like just cars just miss each other and you were just merrily thinking about your, what you usually think about, driving down the freeway and then, you know, 1 second, you know, near accident. And after that near accident, boy, the mind is clear. And like, you know you're clear, you know you're awake. Wow, and this feeling of knowing you're awake, knowing you're aware, stands out in highlight. So mindfulness can do that as it gets stronger. It becomes a power, it becomes kind of a presence, it becomes a refuge, it becomes support that creates a very different context for understanding our life and our issues, because there's a new member of the family, there's a new kind of support for it all that we didn't know about before. And the same thing of the other six factors of awakening. They become powers and strengths, and they become, as Adrian said yesterday, they're jewels. In Buddhism, they're called the true wealth, or the greatest wealth that a person can have. Or among the greatest wealths are these seven jewels of these seven qualities of awakening. And not because, you know, if they're underdeveloped, then, you know, they're not much wealth there. But when they become strong and stand out as powers or strengths, it's incomparable in value what they feel like and what they are. So they involve this journey, and what it means that as we engage in the practice, that slowly these begin to grow and to become more support for us. And we hope that in talking about them in the course of the week, that it will help you appreciate their role in your life, that how they're a resource for you, you can call upon them sometimes, and also when they do arise in your life, you can recognize them, because recognizing them is one of the ways to support them, feed them, help them to grow and become more useful for you. There's an ancient story that's told. I don't know if it was a real or a myth. It has kind of the little makings of a myth, but I think it has a source in historical fact. There was, in fact, an ancient king, and kind of a man called the first Buddhist king. Buddhists claim him, but other religions in India claim him too. Named King Ashoka, King Ashoka. And when he first became king, he was known for his cruelty. And he very viciously went around with his large army and conquered big parts of India and slaughtered lots of people. And then at one point, after a very big battle where 100,000 soldiers, people died in the battle, he was walking across the field looking at the carnage. And he won the battle, but there's all this mayhem and death around him. And as he was walking, looking at it, probably maybe made a deep impression on him, a Buddhist monk walked through the field, the battlefield. And the Buddhist monk had a very peaceful demeanor, very peaceful way of being, that somehow the contrast between maybe the battlefield and the death and how he'd been living his life and what he was up to stood out in very big contrast to the king. So he went over to the monk and asked for some teachings or say something to him. And the monk recited a Buddhist poem that's attributed to the Buddha. And the poem, or verse, goes like this. Vigilance. Some people translate the word as mindfulness, though. It's not sati. It's vigilance or mindfulness. So vigilance. It actually starts differently. Negligence is the path of death. Vigilance is the path to the deathless. Those who are negligent are as if already dead. Those who are vigilant, mindful, will never die. Kind of a powerful poem. And so in the context of this king looking at all this death that he was responsible for, to be told that it's those who are negligent are as if already dead, probably made a big impression on him. And they said this verse turned his heart, turned his mind. And then he became devoted to the Dharma. And Buddhists say it's the Buddha Dharma, and the Jains say it's the Jain Dharma, and probably everybody, all the Indians have Dharma, so. But he became a righteous or Dharma king, and then stopped his violence and did all kinds of wonderful things for his country. And but what a turn. But the turn was this idea to be vigilant, to be attentive, to really be present for our lives, to wake up to it, to be attentive to this life. And that's the path of mindfulness, is to really show up and be attentive, to hear. And that's the first step of these seven factors of awakening, is to cultivate mindfulness, which is the task for this retreat, to wake up, to be present. And it requires things from you. It requires seeing clearly what you're up to, what your mind is up to, so that you don't succumb to the normal currents and activities of the mind mindlessly. if you get caught up in fantasy, caught up in desires, caught up in thoughts and dreams and all kinds of things, it's possible to go on for a long time with this and churn away. But the idea to be mindful means to no longer get seduced by that, no longer get swept away by that. Not to reject it or feel it's bad, but to wake up from the dream of it, to see it clearly for what it is, to come back from it, to let go of it and come back to the present moment. It's not easy to do, or it's not easy to do continuously, but every moment that you bring your mind back from your thoughts to what's happening here and now, to be mindful, is a very powerful moment, And it's not wasted. And slowly, by doing that again and again, the Buddha said, with dripping drops of water, the water jug is filled. So one drop is insignificant, but you put a lot of drops together, they add up. So it might seem frustrating in conventional ways of wanting to be successful, that in a 45-minute period of meditation, it seems like you have to bring your mind back from your thinking, you know, 1,000 times. Like, boy, I'm not very good at this. But with dripping drops of mindfulness, the water jug is filled. It really makes a big difference. And kind of learning to, slowly the mind is training itself and learning not to give in, And many people give in, have been giving in to their mind, the mind's desires and wishes, for a lifetime. And we actually, and so the conditioning, the habit is quite strong. And we, it's really remarkable how quickly the unconditioning happens, the breaking of the habit happens in relative terms. So I don't know what the average age is here, but let's say the average age of someone here is 40. So taking 40 years of, you know, your mind had free rein to do what it wants. That's a long time. And we're just talking about 1 week here of your life. And you'll probably see that as the week goes along, just 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 times coming back is going to have a profound effect on you by the end of the week. You probably feel calmer, more present, more intimate with your experience than you were when you came. And I know I'm very respectful of how difficult it is to be present sometimes because of how strong the mind is. So I like to offer you a practice that I do. When my mind is very busy and I'm churning away with something and I can't seem to quiet it down or settle it so I can be present here, then I stop trying to do that. You know, reining in or let go. But what I do instead, I have this practice where I say to myself the word here, H-E-R-E, here. And I don't say it like a command to a dog, you know, but rather it's more like a word that I use to open my attention, my doors of perception, and I say here because I'm acknowledging I'm here, here and now, this is where I am, And then I say here, and then like opening the doors of perception to take in the experience of being here as it is. And so the experience of being of here might be, here's a mind that's out of control. And then I kind of take that in. What does that feel like? I don't try to stop it then, let go of it. I just kind of feel, oh, this is what it's like. A lot of energy, a lot of constriction, a lot of tightness, a lot of concerns, maybe some emotions connected to it. Here, this is what it's like. And it just takes, you know, 2 moments to do it here, and then, oh, it's like this. And then I do it again, here. So I'm not struggling or fighting against my mind. I'm not trying to let go. I'm not trying to reject or be upset about or judge what's going on. But I'm trying to, I give myself just a few moments to feel or sense or to recognize, to take in, here. This is what it's like now. And what happens to me when I do that, I am stepping away from the activity of fueling or being involved in all my thoughts for a moment. I'm not letting go. I'm not trying to stop it, but it's like I'm taking a step back and looking at it for a moment. And I keep doing it for a while, and as I do that, the fuel for the thinking begins to no longer fueling or perpetuating the thinking that I'm involved in. Here's I think a remarkable analogy. If you go to a discovery museum, exploratorium, or something where museum science for kids, many of them have these really big bowls. And sometimes they have marbles, and sometimes they have little coins or something that you put in at the top. And it goes in, and it's marbles, and it goes around and around, and sometimes it goes down nice spirals, but sometimes it goes, starts going kind of crazy, and goes up and down and around and about. But if you leave it alone, the marble will slowly settle, momentum will go out, and finally, if there's no hole at the bottom, it'll finally come to rest, the bottom of the bowl. If there's a hole at the bottom, then if momentum is fast, it just goes right over the hole. But as it gets slow enough, it just falls through the hole very nicely. But anyway, this idea of coming to rest at the center. Maybe this is I don't know if it's the best analogy, given how in English we talk about having marbles, loose marbles. We all have loose marbles. Our head is kind of like a bowl, and we have these marbles, these thoughts that are spinning around. There's a lot of momentum. And just like with the bowl, the physical bowl with the marble, if you go along with your finger and push the marble and put more momentum in it, it'll just keep spinning for a long time, forever. But if you stop pushing the marble, it'll come to rest at the bottom. So the same thing with the mind. If we keep getting involved and reacting to our thoughts and thinking more and more, it's like adding momentum, and of course it doesn't stop the thinking. So one of the things to do is to stop being bothered by your thoughts. Amazing thing, if you're bothered by your thoughts, then you're actually putting more momentum in them. So it's okay that you're thinking. You're a human being after all. So that's what we do. So don't be bothered. It's okay. It's really okay. But here's a person who's thinking, and it's like this. It's like this to be thinking. So you're kind of like stepping back, looking at it, and kind of, oh, I see. As if you've never noticed what it's like to have a mind that thinks. Oh, it's like, that's how it is. And then you step away, and you're not, that moment or two of observing, you're not pushing the marble along anymore. And slowly do that a while, then maybe the mind begins to settle down. And then you're ready to be present here. Maybe come back to the breathing and just be with the breath. One of the reasons why the breath is often offered as a meditation subject is that the breath is a physical experience. It's not a thought. And the more you can be with in your body and your mind, many people find it's easier not to get pulled into the world of thoughts and react to it and perpetuate it. And the breathing is also relaxing. Feeling your breath, allowing yourself to feel and take in the breath. It can be a relaxing phenomena. So mindfulness. We cultivate mindfulness here of whatever is going on. I think it's helpful to not have too narrow a definition of what mindfulness is. Some people think that have learned the idea that mindfulness means noting, or this mental activity of cognizing, recognizing what's happening while it's happening. So we hear a bird sound. People say to themselves, bird sound, I'm recognizing a bird. That's a bird sound. It's kind of conceptual. The group of factors that come into play when we are attentive includes cognitive, includes that recognition, but it's much richer. The world, to really be present in the present moment, to be really fully here, connected and rested in a present moment experience, is much richer then a movement of the mind to cognize what's happening. Our capacity for awareness, which is so wonderful, uses maybe all our attentional faculties, and maybe in different ways at different times. One of the ways that I like to think of mindfulness, especially when I get started and getting kind of settled in to it, is to think of mindfulness as more, rather than being mindful, like being in the control tower, watching the experience, it's more like I'm in the experience feeling it. So to feel the breathing, to feel the experience, to be in, so if you're feeling, you know, the chest expand and contract, or the belly expand and contract and move, to be in the movement as opposed to being separate from it. Feel and sense and savor that experience. If you're eating your food, don't be in the control tower thinking about the food, but rather kind of almost like you're dwelling in the tongue and the body, allowing yourself to really register in the senses. So to be in the senses, rather than mindfulness, can be sensefulness, in that you're fully in your senses, like, as opposed to fully in your mind, which I guess, I don't know what mindfulness, I think mindfulness was maybe a poor choice to translate the Buddhist word sati. The person who came up with it, an Englishman who came up with it, borrowed from the King James Bible. And so, because it's kind of properly religious context, so they, you know, Buddhism is religion. But sensefulness, to come here and be here. So some of you today, I'm sure many of you, have felt challenged, difficult the first day. Some people have headaches the first day. People are very tired, as we talked about. The body can be aching a lot. And so it's a, to have all these challenges is part of the practice. And part of what we learn to do is to learn how to practice with this, as opposed to, say, getting caught up in the thoughts, this shouldn't be happening, and I have to figure out how to get rid of this and fix it. You know, Adrian said, instructions, don't fix it. I'll try to fix it, and only if I can finally get this headache away, if my back wasn't hurt, if only, then I can really practice. The art of this practice of mindfulness is to somehow figure out how to show up fully for the experience you're having. So in that fully showing up, you haven't succumbed to the reactivity to it. You haven't succumbed to the judgments and the resistance and the desires and the fears, but you're just there fully for that. And I find it helpful then for mindfulness to have this component of, like if there's a headache, become the headache. Just really be there and sense it and feel it. Be right in the middle of it. Figure out where is it. And don't be apart from it, because then it's easy to be kind of reactive to it. But just kind of find the middle of it, and the headache, and then be really rest in the middle of it. See if you can find some way to have the mind rest or be still or to be quiet right in the middle of the discomfort you're having. And what happens then? That's a kind of mindfulness. Then you're connected to the present moment and you're aware of the present moment when you're doing that. When you're so to find some way to be intimate to this experience, to be connected to the experience, to not be distracted from the experience, to almost like become the experience, so you really get to know it and feel it well, then it starts becoming clear what's going on. And remember I talked about the hourglass, right? So as we get into the present moment more and more, slowly the hourglass, the other side of the hourglass opens up, and we start seeing the richer world that we're living in. One of the parts of the richer world we see how valuable it is to experience our life through, with reference to our body, to be grounded and connected to our body, at rest in our body. I think that bodyfulness is a better translation than mindfulness, because of so much of this practice means coming into your body, experiencing your life through your body, through your lived experience. Your body is always in the present moment. Your mind might not be. And if you want your mind and body to be in the same place at the same time, to be in harmony with each other, then it's the task of bringing the mind to where the body is, here and now. It doesn't really make sense to bring your body to where your mind is. So you bring it here. So come into your body. We start discovering that part of the richness of this present moment is the world of how things are pleasant and unpleasant. There's a whole kaleidoscope of shifting sand of pleasant and unpleasant that goes on. And there's no judgment necessarily, things are pleasant or unpleasant, but it's amazing how much of our life is caught up and involved in avoiding the unpleasant and trying to have the pleasant. And that's not a life of freedom. That's not a recipe for waking up, to always be going after pleasant and always avoiding unpleasant. And so to begin, part of this opening up to the present moment is to becoming aware of how we live in relationship to the pleasant and the unpleasant. And maybe experimenting or beginning to find out how to be unreactive, how to just let it be. Something is unpleasant, just keep breathing. Keep breathing, keep staying present. Just be with it. If things are pleasant, just keep breathing, just be with it. No need to indulge in it or lean into it or make a story of it. Just be where it is. I've been on retreats like this kind of retreat, and you know, it's kind of amazing what the mind does. Things are going along really well, and when I was a new practitioner, I had all these fantasies about how I was going to tell all my friends and be a retreat evangelist, and I was going to someday in the way of future, I was going to become a meditation teacher, and I would make up all these sermons I would give about how wonderful it is to be mindful and how you should practice mindfulness, and not recognizing that I was not being mindful one bit, because I was lost in this fantasy of making up Dharma talks. This is so because it was so great, and I felt loved that so much. And that would last for, you know, half an hour. And then my knee would hurt, and my back would hurt, and I'd get tired, and whatever. And then, like, oh, you know, and then my mind would go off again. And I would, this is terrible. You know, reasonable people don't do this kind of thing. And I'd come up with a long list of explanations of why this was ridiculous. The human beings would go off for a week and sit in silence and not move. Bodies were made to move, you know, they're supposed to move, and this is unnatural not to move, and the mind is supposed to be creative and think about wonderful things, and they're telling me to let go of my thoughts, and, you know, I have important things to do, and you know, I'm wasting my time, and, you know, and I think that I should write a treatise about save a lot of people suffering by explain, you know, how terrible this is. And then in my mind, and then next sitting I'd come back, or next day I'd come back, and I'd be really calm and kind of really enjoying it and peaceful, and wow, this is great. I gotta tell my friends. How can I do this again? And then I'd have the, how can I go on another retreat fantasy? Because it's so great to be on retreat. I started planning my next retreat, how to get the retreat. Not noticing that I'm on retreat. I'm going to practice really good at the next retreat, not think about anything. So you get the idea, right? So as we enter into this, you know, the big part of the hourglass of the present moment, we start seeing the tricks of the mind and what goes on, and we start not believing those tricks as much. And that's a very important juncture of human life, is to be able to really recognize the trains of thought that we get on, and just see them as trains and not get on. Let them be. And part of the advantage of this letting them be is that then we also start seeing more and more as we get into this big hourglass, we're seeing that one of the most precious things we have is the quality of our own hearts and minds. That the quality of our hearts and minds is the, you know, that's where, you know, our greatest beauty, the greatest value, the greatest thing is. Compassion, love, peace, generosity, wisdom, All these things belong to the aspect of the quality of the heart, the quality of the mind. And so as we're more mindful, as we enter this world mindfully with attention and kind of living more fully in the lived experience, these things begin slowly to show themselves more and more, and we see them. And we see the quality of our heart, the quality of the mind. Sometimes what we see is that it's not so good, that quality. There's a lot of, could be a lot of anger, or it could be a lot of sadness or grief or many things. One of the things I'd encourage you to, how to approach a retreat like this, is no matter what arises for you out of your hearts while you're sitting here in this retreat, allow it to come. It's not a mistake. In fact, one of the pieces of advice I'd like to give is that when something significant happens, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant here on the retreat, especially if something difficult happens, imagine that you're looking at your wristwatch and you say to yourself, right on time. Especially if you have your mind set, your mind says, this shouldn't be happening, then look at your wristwatch, right on time. Whatever happens, it's right on time. And especially the inner life. If there's sadness and grief and fear and anger and memories that arise from the past, don't take it as a problem. Right on time. The Dharma, your heart, knows what you need better than you do. The Dharma knows what you need. And so if things begin bubbling up that are not easy or that are difficult, these difficult emotions, it's really healthy and good to allow them to flow. And the task is to be mindful of them. So here it's like this. Here it's like this. And just kind of step back for a moment and recognize it. Make space for it. Allow for it. This allowing for inner life to unfold is one of the key responsibilities of a practitioner. Not to be involved, not to get carried away in the thoughts and stories like that, but to allow it, because our inner life has a tremendous capacity for healing, has a tremendous capacity to move to liberation. One of the ways that Buddha talked about the path to liberation was not as a path, but was as a river. And you enter into that river, and you're carried along by the current, the natural current that leads you along down the path. So we see the quality of our hearts, and we see what's there, and we meet it with kindness, we meet it with compassion the best we can. And as we meet it with presence, with time, some of the new qualities begin developing. Like the seven factors of awakening, becoming them stronger and stronger. There is a tradition in Buddhism, Buddhist practice in our tradition, that especially in the context of a retreat like this, that really everything follows in the wake of mindfulness. So you just keep waking up to what's happening in the moment, coming back and be present, recognize what's happening. Best of your ability, try not to get caught up in some of the trains of thoughts and trains of stories, trains of judgments, trains of right and wrong that you might be caught up in. Just step back and recognize. Keep recognizing. This is what's happening. This is what's happening. And then recognize, feel it, and relax. Keep relaxing with what's here. It's okay. Recognize, feel, and relax. Then with time, as time goes along, at some point, awareness itself, mindfulness itself, starts becoming strong enough that it becomes part of what we're aware of. I know it seems a little bit like a paradox to say you become awareness is aware of itself, but that's what happens. It's kind of like I drive around the peninsula a lot, and I can spend days just not driving around, living my life, doing what I do, and not notice the air quality until there's been rain or wind or something has changed, and I look across the bay to Fremont there in those hills, and I was like, wow. I had no idea. I forgot there were mountains over the hills over there, and they're so clear. And it isn't simply that I see the places, but now I see the clarity of the air. Because it's, clarity means like something, you know, it's not really there, right? That's why it's clear. And so, but wow, I see the clarity. So the same thing that we see as we become more and more mindful. Wow. The mindfulness becomes clear. The awareness becomes clear. Or like those of you who have glasses, you know, I've had people tell me, your glasses are really dirty. Oh, I didn't know. And then I take them off, I clean them. Wow. So the mind is that way. So with time, as we keep doing this and doing it and doing it, slowly, keep relaxing. Keep being kind of relaxed and okay with how things are. Just relying on mindfulness. Then things, someday you'll have this clarity of awareness stands out. And it becomes support. It becomes a power that becomes very supportive in our lives. So Dogen says, all my life, false and real, right and wrong, tangled, confused, caught up, attached maybe. Playing with the moon, ridiculing the wind, listening to birds. So here is a Zen master who's playing with awakening, playing with whatever, I don't know how he was playing with it, ridiculing the wind, ridiculing the people involved in success and failure and praise and blame and all the things that the winds of the world, listening to the birds. Many years wasted seeing the mountain covered with snow. So this is also, remember, this is all these kinds of nature poetry in Japanese Buddhism are very meant to be symbolic. So here, wasted seeing the mountain covered with snow. So they said, something is there, but it's covered, and it's beautiful. In this case, this winter, I suddenly realize snow makes the mountain. This year, I realize suddenly realize that snow makes the mountain. In other words, he is no longer seeing that the mountain is covered by the snow. But rather, what he sees directly, that's what he's seeing. He's just seeing the snow. He's seeing a snow mountain. He's not looking behind it. He's not tangled up in right and wrong, success and failure, true and real. But rather, he's now seeing directly this moment. What's in front of him? What's obvious? He's not looking behind the snow. So I don't know what he means by the snow here, but I kind of like the idea that, you know, since it's symbolic, you're allowed to, you know, analyze it. Snow is cold. And if it's a really cold, like Japanese winters in the mountains can be really cold. Cold and hard, icy snow. What do you have that snow, cold, you overlay on top of reality in life? That there's a real thing behind that. But I think it's quite something. He wakes up, to wake up to what's here and what's obvious. To what you see, what you smell, what you hear, what you taste, what you sense, what you feel. Here, this lived life, this what we perceive and connect to, here. So this is a kind of an awakening poem. A man who was in some ways already awake, but something about his enlightenment, I suspect, he missed something. And there are people who miss something when they get some kind of realization experience, because they think, oh, that experience, that's what I have to have. And then the experiences come and go. But the ability to be awake and to connect to this moment of reality, and see it just simply as this experience, is key to this path of practice. So I hope that you find many opportunities here in the quiet, the silence, simplicity of our life together here at IRC, that you can just be present for the simplicity of what's happening at this moment, and then again for this moment, and letting these moments grow and continue and unfold. It's the continuity of this continuity of these moments that really begin to put you on a journey, and a journey of transformation. So it's the custom here that at the end of a talk, we often will go back into our meditation posture and just take a minute or so to kind of reconnect to ourselves, relax into ourselves as a transition to go back into the practice mode that we have.